Hello, my name is Haley Palumbo, and this is Unknown America on WGXC, ACRA 90.7 FM. Unknown America is a weekly radio show that casts a light on the lesser-known people, places, events, and otherwise overlooked aspects of the United States of America's history, be they mysterious, dark, comical, strange, or otherwise valuable. This episode will concern the Burlington Liars Club in Wisconsin and its history, an organization that nominates a yearly Liar of the Year, and I'll talk a bit about the career of esteemed liar and pioneer of the American circus, P.T. Barnum. Stay tuned. Have you ever told a lie? I figure you have, because most everyone has lied. Here's some statistics. Most people lie at least once a day. 40% of people lie in their resumes. By 4 years of age, 90% of children understand the concept of telling a lie, likely lying occasionally to their parents, as most lies, by adults or children, are told to our parents. 80% of all lies told are white lies, things that in the long run are not hugely consequential, but occasionally you'll meet a prolific liar, somebody who lies about anything and everything, their background, their accomplishments, and even their interests and hobbies. They'll spin yarns so elaborate in their scope that it becomes difficult to know if they're being honest about anything. In 1929, these people were made a home in Burlington, Wisconsin. It was called the Burlington Liars Club. The origin of the Burlington Liars Club was, funnily enough, perhaps based on a lie. A correspondent for the Milwaukee Journal and the Chicago Daily News named Manuel Hahn was having trouble putting food on the table. It was a slow year for local news at the town newspaper he worked at. He decided that if he was going to make any money, he needed to come up with an excellent story. Since there were no stories to tell, other than reporting on the occasional Wisconsinite receiving a ticket or getting into trouble with the law, he decided to take things into his own hands and fabricate one. Manuel, often mispronounced as Manuel, was desperate for some kind of idea as to what to write about. He had a whole lot of bills to pay. He sat down at his desk and got to thinking. After a while, he landed on writing about a liar's club. The Liars Club he described in his article was a panel of judges that awarded medals to a liar that they chose from a group of hand-picked contestants that they considered to be the all-time best, within their town of Burlington, Wisconsin, that is. The contestant who came up with the most bombastic, engaging, creative, and funny lie was awarded a medal and a title of the World Champion Liar. While this at first blush sounds like a pretty crazy story, it was actually rooted in reality to some degree. There really was a bit of a liar's club, if a very informal one. It was a group of firemen, police officers, the police chief, newspaper writers, and a few older retired men that resided in Burlington, Wisconsin, Manuel Hahn included, that met up at the police station every week to try to outlie each other for no reason other than their own amusement. Hahn decided that this was funny enough of a thing to turn into a story he could pass off as real. The following is an account of the basis of the story of the Liars Club. Most of my account of the Liars Club is based on Manuel's telling of it. It is excellently written. To me, he writes like Ring Lardner, if you're familiar, who was a sports columnist primarily based in Chicago in the early 1900s. I will be reading a few passages directly from his account so you can enjoy it too. There was a basis of fact for my yarn. Every morning, a group of quite reputable persons met in the police station and swapped stories. There were a couple of lawyers, the older retired men of the city, the police chief, an officer or two, and the two newspaper men, Otis C. Hewlett of the Racine paper, and myself. Telling tall tales was our daily pastime. They ranged from actual experiences in the World War and sailing the seven seas. We had a retired captain as one of our regulars, to yarns taxing the imagination of the seller and the credulity of the listener. Any particularly vivid lie was sure to rouse a cry from Pink Shenning, a red-headed policeman,
of Give Him the Medal.
In the story he made up, Mantle wrote that the candidates for the world's best liar were presented before a jury comprised of lawyers and newspapermen who were deemed competent to judge lies. The award in this fictitious story was given to a retired sea captain named Anthony Delano for his story of a whale he once passed on his travels that he measured to be about 3 miles long. Delano did actually exist and was a resident of Burlington, Wisconsin, where the story is based, and a member of the original, quote-unquote, Liars Club. Upon reading his story, the Milwaukee Journal was delighted. They wanted to send somebody down to take a photograph of the award winner with his medal. Mantle, despite having absolutely no idea how he was going to pull it off, reluctantly agreed to the photo shoot and got to work figuring out what to do. He got in touch with a photographer for the Milwaukee Journal, his name was Charles Warner, and Captain Delano, the fictitious winner of the World Champion Liar Award, and had some private pictures taken for the newspaper. He pulled a medal he received in South America, the actual nature of this medal is not public knowledge, and got a photograph of Chief Beller, one of the police officers in his Liars Club, pinning it to the lapel of the sea captain in question who was in on the lie, Captain Delano. According to Mantle, there had actually been a leather medal awarded once to Delano legitimately, but the whereabouts of the medal are currently unknown. The article was published, and Han received his check for the article. Case closed, or so he thought. Little did he know, his story was making the rounds. Shortly after the initial publication of his story, a news station had condensed his article into a few paragraphs and broadcast Mantle's tale over the air. Then, a Burlingtonian in Florida who was on vacation at the time of the article's publication saw an adaptation of the article in a Florida newspaper, and he clipped it out and mailed it to Mantle, who was very amused. Then a newspaper in New York City caught wind of the story and published it, and then Los Angeles. The entirely fictitious Burlington Liars Club was making national news fast. Mantle found this to be pretty hilarious, and shortly afterwards, the United Press hired him to publish a weekly column in the same theme of his first article. Shortly after this, he finally got a real job in Chicago, one that paid all of his bills and more, and he moved to a suburb outside of city limits. His fib ended up being a huge turning point, if not a crowning achievement of his career, and most people were none the wiser that it was in fact all made up. Some time passed. About a year after the initial publication, Mantle received some interesting news out of the blue. He had not thought about the story in a long time. Here's Mantle's account of what occurred.
A year after my magnum opus had been unveiled to the world, I was invited back to Burlington for a New Year's Eve party and was just getting ready to leave when the Chicago Tribune called. Was I the president of the Burlington Liars Club? It was the first I had heard of such an office, but a quick thought assured me I had invented the club, so could also invent its president. I tried to get the reason for the question, but they hung up.
It turns out many major news outlets, the Chicago Tribune included, were clamoring to know who won World's Best Liar this year, which was the reason for the contact. Thinking quickly, Mantle awarded it, so to speak, to last year's completely fabricated runner-up. This was reported on in many newspapers as being the honest-to-God truth, dragging the then-fictitious Burlington Liars Club into the spotlight once again. Mantle got to thinking after he told another lie to many major newspapers, who eagerly reported on his story. The Burlington Liars Club was gaining enough notoriety this time around that people were asking about it faster than he could continue to manufacture lies about it. Why not make it a reality? He decided to do just that. Mantle began hunting for a potential location for the Burlington Liars Club, which he located relatively quickly within the town. In Mantle's words,
"The perfect third party was found. It was Lawrence J. Stang, whose variety store had all the traditional characteristics, save one, of the village meeting place. A long, lank proprietor with spectacles on his nose and a full-bellied wood or coal-burning stove. The missing item, of course, is the Cracker Barrel. So Larry, Pink, and Odie formed a partnership and moved from the harsh cleanliness of the police station to the comfortable, photogenic atmosphere of Larry's big stove."
After getting established at Stang's General Store, they began to get organized. Membership cards were printed. Apparently some actual medals were produced for those awarded the title of world champion liar, but none of these can be found. Manel's bizarre tale that he told to pay his bills and put food on the table was evolving into something a lot bigger than he thought it would. Long letters from liars around the country were piling up. Captivated by the Burlington Liars Club, they spun their own yarns in an attempt to secure the title of world champion liar. Here's a lie told to the club in one of the letters, relayed by Manel. The liar won the third and up, until that point, only legitimate title.
Orrin Butts of Bay City, Michigan. Orrin was the hero of an emergency operation in which a farmer, devastatingly gored by a bull, was reviscerated with the stomach of a close-to-hand sheep. The farmer recovered, but not long after grew horns, and after the second year sprouted wool all over, so that thereafter he sheared 30 to 40 pounds each spring.
Another excellent one, in his words, that secured the fourth world champion liar title.
Phil McCarty told how his cat lost a foreleg. The cat having been a master mouser, out of gratitude, Phil fashioned an old-style peg to the stump. After Kitty had accustomed herself to the new limb, imagine Phil's surprise when her mousing score increased. Instead of the former use of claws, Kitty developed a new technique. She hid in the shadows and brained the mice with her peg leg, used as a club.
On a personal note, I would love to have been the one to get to read all of these amazing letters. In its long tenure, the Burlington Liars Club received thousands and thousands of handwritten letters from fibbers all over the country. People of all different ages, children and adults, social classes, men and women both, and the rich and poor, wrote in with their lies in an attempt to receive the prize. Only one winner can be chosen each year, but there's no doubt that there was some seriously amazing creativity present in the entries. I particularly love to read all the lies told by kids who entered the contest. I bet that they're especially creative and absurd. In good time, the club had more than enough money to replace the wood-burning stove in the store that they met in for a heat source a bit more modern and up-to-date, which they amassed from the $1 fee it cost to both join the Burlington Liars Club and submit your lie. But winning the award of World Champion Liar did not earn you any actual money or prize of a monetary value. You just got the title, your name in the newspaper, and a handsome membership card printed on nice sturdy paper. Before 33, you had to be over the age of 70 and a resident of Burlington, Wisconsin. A few years after this, fueled by a great deal of interest from the public outside of Burlington, they opened the contest up to people across the U.S. There was no shortage of mail from people all over America. In just the first couple of years, they received no less than 1,500 letters. A few decades later, when the contest began to be a worldwide competition, contestants all over the world were invited to write in with their lies, which they did. For a while, there was only one rule as to who could not write in after the rule about the winner needing to be from Burlington, Wisconsin was lifted. No professional liars were allowed. All this means is no politicians or lawyers could compete, as the very nature of their profession was generally telling small or large lies. There are a few exceptions, though. Sometimes the best professional liar title is given to one. A brief aside, my very favorite lie that I read has to be the winner from 1933. It's also the favorite lie of Manel Hahn. Here it is in Manel's words.
Out of the whole crop, the 1933 winner seems to me, a retired connoisseur of lies, the outstanding lie to date. It was the effort of Bruno Ceresa of Langloth, Pennsylvania. His grandfather, related Bruno, had a clock so old that no one knew how long it had been in service, but there was a hole through the back of the case where the shadow of the swinging pendulum had worn through.
I think that's such a clever and beautiful image. There's a photo I came across in my research of Bruno Ceresa. He was a man who resembled Harpo Marx a bit in the face, with a shock of black hair that could be a wig in a baggy suit. In the photo, he's standing in front of the microphone, presumably relaying his lie to an audience after winning his title. I could be wrong about that, though. I mention this photo of him because it's worth looking up. He's clearly a character, as I'm sure a lot of these winners were, especially the earlier ones. He has a vaudeville meets used car salesman look about him and a friendly, easy smile. He does look like he could be right out of the movies. That's something I like about looking at a lot of photographs of people from the 20s and 30s. I don't know whether or not it's the black and white, high contrast nature of the images, or the fashion, but everybody looks like they could be from the movies to me. I would have loved to talk to Bruno. He probably had some really interesting stories to tell. Whether or not they were actually true is besides the point. My second favorite lie that I read was submitted by a 12-year-old girl who won the 60th Burlington Liars Club World Champion Liar Contest. She claimed that her sister was so thin that she could use a Cheerio for a hula hoop. That's so funny to envision. I love the way kids' brains work. I really hope she still has the membership card in her wallet. Here's Mantle talking about what kind of lies are told to the Burlington Liars Club by contestants seeking out the prize.
What kind of lies come in? Only a few rise above what might be called type lies. Practically everyone entered conforms to the pattern of exaggeration. Most of them are duplicates in structure of age-old lies. One of the favorites is some variant on the snake that struck a fence post or hole handle, which then grew so large that 243 cords of wood came from it before it was down to its original size again. Another is some variant of the Grand Canyon guide who fell from the top of the canyon while wearing rubber boots. He landed on his feet and bounced back up, thus saving his life, but he kept right on bouncing, so after 3 days they had to shoot him to keep him from starving to death. Others fall definitely into the Paul Bunyan saga, such as the fish so large it took 48 hours for the water to fill the hole in the river when it was pulled out, or the railroad locomotive so large that a man who fell into the water tank next showed up in the gauge glass, and very definitively the story of the wells in Kansas which, after a severe dust storm, stuck out of the ground so far that farmers roofed them over for silos. This is a direct borrowing of Paul Bunyan's well in Dakota that stuck up 634 feet after a storm until he sawed it down and split it up into post holes, which he sold to the farmers in Missouri for more than his lumber cut yielded. One thing is evident, and a matter of pride for America, all of the stories are clean parlor stories.
The Burlington Liars Club has remained active, save for a brief hiatus in 1980 due to perceived lack of interest. The club was revived the very next year, though. At this point, it had been active for nearly 100 years. Nowadays, the Burlington Liars Club is nowhere near what it was in its heyday. There's no brick and mortar location for the club save for a bar in Burlington that calls itself the Liars Club as a nod to the association. They hold a music festival every year called Tall Tales. In 2020, the Burlington Liars Club only received 75 letters in total, compared to what they used to get. The winner still does make the end of year news, though, if not in as elaborate a fashion as they used to. If you'd like to enter the contest for 2024, mail your tall tale to the Burlington Liars Club, P.O. Box 156, Burlington, Wisconsin, 53105, or send an email to championlies@gmail.com along with your name, address, and your tall tale. If you or someone you know would like to become an official card-carrying member of the Burlington Liars Club, include $1 for each membership along with a self-addressed stamped envelope. I'm not sure what country on earth is the most prone to telling tall tales and stretching the truth. I do know that America certainly has a long and illustrious history of it. Whether it's to advertise something, entertain, or simply make the truth a bit more compelling, it's all over the country's history. When I sat down to research this episode, I tasked myself with coming up with some of the USA's best and most notorious liars, and the most historically significant lies. A figure that was certainly one of the most influential liars ever was P.T. Barnum. If you're not familiar with him, P.T. Barnum was an American showman, businessman, and politician. He's most often remembered as being the man who founded the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. I would call him the great-great-grandfather of the American hoax. I'm going to talk a bit about one of the first notable Barnum creations, Barnum's American Museum. P.T. Barnum was a fascinating figure. He seemed to have absolutely no problem creating, and more significantly platforming, many hoaxes. He lied in an attempt to entertain people, and it seems above all, to make more money. The phrase, "there's a sucker born every minute," has often been attributed to him, but there's no concrete proof he actually said it. It is attributed to him for a reason, though. By all accounts, it seems to be an accurate credo by which he lived his life. At the start of his career, Barnum purchased an entire museum in New York City called the Scudder's American Museum, which he renamed after himself, Barnum's American Museum, and then used it to display various hoaxes and human curiosities, including the Fiji mermaid, which was just the torso of a monkey sewn onto a fish, and General Tom Thumb, a man with dwarfism who attained a wild degree of success in his tenure as P.T. Barnum's performer. Barnum's museum also notably contained the very first aquarium established in the United States, and several exhibits that were totally legitimate in their scientific value. It was a very mixed bag, which is what made the museum fascinating. You did not know if you were looking at something that was completely real or totally made up. And back in the late 1800s, there was more of an inclination to believe what you were being told, as you could not fact-check anything on your phone. Things were less cynical and less frequently questioned, so that the sense of wonder with which people embraced hoaxes was more prominent. Before its eventual destruction, P.T. Barnum's museum was a zoo, wax museum, theater, freak show, lecture hall, and a lot more. Here is only a short list of some of the articles it contained. Dioramas, panoramas, cosmoramas, scientific instruments, modern appliances, a flea circus, a loom powered by a dog, the trunk of a tree under which Jesus' disciples supposedly sat, an oyster bar, a rifle range, waxworks, glass blowers, taxidermists, pretty baby contests, Ned the Learned Seal, the Fiji mermaid, conjoined twins, menagerie of exotic animals that included beluga whales, Native Americans who performed traditional songs and dances, trained bears, and live performances by magicians. This was only part of what you could see at the museum. At its peak, the museum was open 15 hours a day and had as many as 15,000 visitors a day. Bear in mind the population of the U.S. was only around 32 million when the museum was open in the latter half of the 1800s, so 15,000 visitors a day is no small feat. Some of the most engaging parts of the museum, and favorites among a lot of museum goers, were the more fantastical exhibits. This included the Fiji mermaid, the flea circus, and the tree trunk that was used as a chair by disciples of Jesus, supposedly. Unfortunately, human beings were also on display, advertising people as circus acts or freak show members for reasons that range from the color of their skin to birth defects. A couple of performers included supposed Aztec children who were from El Salvador, and two supposed Siamese twins named Chang and Ing. They were real conjoined twins, but Barnum played up their supposed cultural heritage a great deal to attract more attention. Since it was rare to see people who were, at the time, a vast minority in the US, and it was not possible to simply get out your phone and Google Siamese twin like it is today, and look at a picture of them to satisfy your curiosity, or better than that, to distinguish fact from myth, people were quite unfortunately mystified and fascinated by these people, while Barnum drew a spectacular profit. In his very feeble defense, he did apparently pay his exploited performers very well, in some cases the equivalent of what sports stars would make today. And later on, he did attempt to persuade the public that he was sorry for his various exploitations, but you have to bear in mind that he was running for political office at the time. He could have been saying anything to try to get a vote. He could have been saying anything to get what he wanted. So take his apology with a grain of salt. P.T. Barnum's more ridiculous and controversial exhibits were generally heavily promoted acts of deception on Barnum's part. But one of the key factors in the American Museum's success was Barnum's advertising strategy, which involved embellishing the truth a great deal. Barnum aimed to make the museum the town wonder and talk of the town, in his words. To achieve this, he was willing to, in his words, exploit his patrons' ignorance from time to time. It didn't seem like people minded it all that much. If you listen to the Unknown America episode about House on the Rock, he reminds me a bit of Alex Jordan Jr. in that way. I don't feel like it would make all that big of a difference if people knew they were being lied to in this case. They were being entertained. That's a strange thing about the circus and carnivals. There are qualities about them that are obvious scams. It's pretty obvious you're being deceived, but you're allowing it to happen because you're having that great of a time. I have mixed feelings about circuses entirely due to their treatment of some of their animals, but there's admittedly somewhat of a magical feeling about them, like you're partaking in a very old ritual where you have to hang your preconceived notions about reality at the door to get full enjoyment of the experience. Barnum leveraged the appeal of his popular attractions by often publishing newspaper articles that claimed his exhibits were fake, enticing audiences to return to see them for themselves. He produced numerous large, colorful posters showcasing the museum's various exhibits. These posters frequently exaggerated the attractions, yet visitors continued to return even after they'd been misled. The poster for the Fiji Mermaid was so large it covered most of the museum's front. Again, the Fiji Mermaid was a monkey sewn to a fish, but it drew in incredibly large crowds that were shocked and astonished by it. In November 1864, the Confederate Army of Manhattan made an unsuccessful attempt to set the museum on fire. However, on July 13, 1865, the American Museum was completely destroyed in an unrelated fire. During the fire, it's said that a firefighter named Johnny Denham killed an escaped tiger with his axe before heroically carrying a 400-pound woman, one of the circus acts, out of the burning building on his shoulders. This has not been confirmed as being totally factual by any source. Barnum's new museum opened September 6, 1865, but it too burned down on March 3, 1868. I guess stuff was really flammable back then? After these events, Barnum transitioned into politics and the circus industry. I'll end this episode with a funny story about P.T. Barnum. He was quite poor, but when he was a young child, he had no idea. His grandfather, another huckster, maybe it ran in the family, told him he was the richest child in town. When he begged him to see his inheritance, he walked P.T., his friends, and some family a mile to a swamp, gestured to it flamboyantly, and said, "There it is!" His friends and family roared with laughter, and after a moment, P.T. Barnum did too. Maybe it's a little fun to be lied to. This has been Unknown America on 90.7 WGXC, ACRA. Haley Palumbo, signing off.